So to get to Bassett Creek from Robbinsdale, at least when I was growing up, you would walk over to Sunset Hill. It was the second highest point on the Minneapolis Parkway system. And when Theodore Wirth was surveying the area and deciding which way the parkway should go, he was very excited to have this view from Sunset Hill. And you looked off toward where St. Margaret Mary's Church was. It kind of is where 26th Avenue North meets the parkway. So he was excited to have this great view, but he knew that it was probably going to get filled up with houses because McNair Manor was already a thing and they were laying out streets and he wanted to preserve this view. So he convinced the Minneapolis Park Board to buy some land to stretch from Sunset Hill down to this little series of ponds that were just below St. Margaret Mary's Church. So as you walked through this thing that was called Glenview Park, you would eventually get to a little stretch of woods and a steep hill would go down, and on that little steep hill, there were little pieces of rock that reminded me of the rock that you see when you go to Minnehaha Falls. And I was told by a geology teacher at one point the Mississippi River had gone through this valley or another giant river way back in the Ice Age. And so these little pieces of rock were always very intriguing. Now, they could also have been somebody just dumping their landscaping down the hill. But to me, they were the pieces of rock, and maybe I could find a fossil. There was also an old car back in those woods that was had been there since the 50s that was pretty intriguing, and a series of ponds. And then when you came up and over the railroad tracks, you would get into this really neat neighborhood of Golden Valley with these rolling hills. And I had been to the library, and I had got this great book called A Zoo in Your Room. And so I wanted to have animals and little aquariums in my room, as many as I possibly could. And down there, where Bassett Creek starts going into Worth Park and the golf course, there was a great place to catch crayfish, frogs, and toads of all sorts. And so we would go down there with our buckets and our water, and we'd get our collections of toads and frogs and crayfish and bring them back to our house. And I had a little aquarium set up. And somehow it seems bizarre because I'll never know to this day how this happened. But a couple of the crayfish got loose, and I thought, well, can't figure out where they've gone. But my mother's vacuuming like days later, and she runs into these crayfish, and they're pretty good sized. And she, I mean, first of all, I was just amazed that they could survive out there in the world without any water. But they were still alive, and she had to get them out of the house. And it did lead to other problems because the animals always got loose. And so I had a big swimming pool in the backyard. And I just kept filling it with toads and frogs. And I had a little island in the middle where the toads and the frogs could live. But they inevitably would get out, and my father would go and mow the lawn. And that never went well for the toads and frogs that were out there. I also had a couple turtles. The turtles didn't seem, they seemed to just hang out in the pool. They didn't care. They didn't want to go off and roam. But we got all this stuff because Bassett Creek was flowing through there. And I used to love the little corrugate tunnel under Golden Valley Road. Instead of having a beautiful little bridge like over in Worth Park, they have these nice stone and rock bridges where Bassett Creek flows and goes under the bridge. At Golden Valley Road, is just a big corrugate, like something you would stick under a driveway. And when you walked through that Bassett Creek, which never looked that clean and beautiful, but when you were in that corrugate and you weren't, and there was no muddy bottom, it did seem clean and beautiful. It was a great place to just sit and, let the creek wash over you and dangle your legs out over the end of the corrugate and watch the creek flow off into the golf course. And when you get tired of collecting frogs and toads and turtles and crayfish, you can go collect golf balls. And there's nothing like getting a big basket of golf balls, and as the golfer's wandering by and going over the bridge, just saying, "Hey, you want to buy a golf ball?" Chances are they'll give you a couple bucks for one, and it's pretty easy to get a basket of them. So a lot of great times down at Bassett Creek. It was just part of our playground. And sure, I'm not alone that a lot of Robbinsdale kids probably went down there to play.
Well, that's a great introduction to Bassett Creek. So we're going to talk about the creek a little bit today. And like Pete mentioned, it's part of the watershed. So there are a couple parts of Robbinsdale where the watershed is in the Bassett Creek watershed. So a watershed is if a little raindrop falls, it will eventually roll down into this common body of water. So anywhere in this big kind of circular shape in the West Metro, if a little raindrop falls, it'll roll down eventually into Bassett Creek. So kind of the southern part of Robbinsdale is part of that. And actually, a lot of the West Metro has parts of it. So Bassett Creek starts at Medicine Lake in Plymouth, and it winds its way over to the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. And along the way, it connects to all these different West Metro neighborhoods, mostly through Golden Valley, makes a big S through Golden Valley, but also St. Louis Park, Plymouth, New Hope, Crystal, Minneapolis, Medicine Lake. I may be missing a few there, but there's a whole lot. And so this creek is a pretty major waterway for the area. And kind of a unique thing about the creek is that it's the first one above the falls. So Awamniyomini or St. Anthony Falls, just north of that, the first creek to come into the river is Bassett Creek. So that's kind of been a marker for people to find it. And we're lucky because we know the Dakota name for the creek. So prior to European settlement, it was known as Hahawakpadan, which means loosely Falls Creek. The Mississippi River is called Hahawakpa, Falls River, and the creek is called Hahawakpadan, or Falls Creek. So they're related.
Is there a falls anywhere on Bassett Creek?
No, I think it's more that it's the first creek that comes into the river above the falls. I think that's more of it. And it used to be faster, a little bit wider, a little bit deeper, so maybe some swirling waters, but I think it's connected to that falls on the river.
How did we find out the Dakota name? Was it always just there, or was it lost and somebody noticed it written down somewhere? Or?
Well, Joseph Nicolet came through and mapped some parts of what we now know as Minneapolis, and he referenced it as Falls Creek and was working with Dakota people and collecting language. And then later, I think in the 1980s, a guy named Paul Durand published a book, Where the Waters Gather and the Rivers Meet. And there's a map in there that maps these great indigenous place names, Dakota and Ojibwe. And so it comes from that book.
Do we know the Ojibwe name too?
No, I only know the Dakota.
Okay.
I only know the Dakota. But you raise a good point that a lot of different people used this area. The falls on the Mississippi River were considered sacred, both by the Dakota and other indigenous people. So there were many different groups using this area, but primarily the Dakota here in the West Metro. And the creek is about 13 and a half miles long. So from Medicine Lake to the river is about 13 and a half miles, but it's really windy. So it really winds around. But then that watershed, that drainage area, is 39 square miles. So that's how we get connected to Robbinsdale, those southern parts of Robbinsdale, where if a little drop of rain falls at the high school or in southern Robbinsdale, eventually, somehow, it will roll down into the creek.
That makes sense. It's all downhill from the what we call Glenwood Parkway, or it's between Victor Memorial Drive and Worth Park. There's a hill that starts there, and it does nothing but go down pretty much all the way until you get to Grimes Pond or where St. Mary Mary's Church is.
I'm glad that you mentioned glaciers, because they do play a role in this story. So the Mississippi River used to be a little bit west of where it is now. It was kind of a big, deep channel, and eventually it shifted to the east a little bit. But when it shifted east, the glaciers would roll through these big, giant sheets of ice, and they would carry a lot of sand and dirt and silt with them. So as those glaciers melted, as they receded, that riverbed got filled up. It was kind of squishy. And that's actually where things like Lake Harriet came from. A big block of ice would be left behind. And as it melted, it would create this depression. And then all that water would go down and make a big lake. So the chain of lakes is in that glacial riverbed. And so is the eastern part of Bassett Creek. The Bassett Creek watershed goes through that big old glacial river valley. So if you're thinking about kind of over by the Minneapolis Farmers Market, just a little bit west of that area there is all the Bassett Creek watershed in that glacial river valley.
Yeah, where 394 comes in, you're kind of going between some hills as 394 comes into downtown Minneapolis, which is not too far from, I think, of Bryn Mawr, where the creek disappears.
Yes, the creek got tunneled underground, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But the creek has this beautiful natural area, and still today a lot of it is pretty natural, but mostly deciduous forest and prairie in this area, oak savanna, lots of trees like elms, ironwood, and basswood. It was kind of fun. I went back and looked at the old survey records, and they would write down the big trees and the different kinds of bushes, so you could get some of that information there. And then a lot of wildlife. So you're talking about the crayfish and the turtles and the frogs, all of that. And then some bigger things, too, like wolves and otters and eagle. Some of those big, really iconic Northwood species that we think about really lived along the creek, too.
Turkeys?
Turkeys, yep.
Now, when I was a kid, there were no turkeys, and I don't know why. They appeared, you know, somewhere in the 90s or the 2000s. Yeah.
They figured out how to live in the suburbs. And yeah. I remember when I worked at mosquito control, I used to find these beautiful feathers in the woods. They were like shiny and iridescent. And I was like, what is creating these beautiful feathers? Mm. Turns out it was turkey. They have really pretty feathers.
They do. And they sleep in trees, which is amazing. They fly up into a tree. And I saw it for the first time recently and it just blew me away.
They are kind of amazing, big and awkward. But yeah, they get up there. So there's a lot of wildlife living along the river and the creek. And there's a little bit of evidence that people used to use the creek to transport materials. So as they're part of the fur trade, they're bringing materials down the creek. There's some memories of when European settlers came. The kids would play with Dakota children at the mouth of the creek. So they would play and swim right where the creek and the river come together. And there was even a canoe ferry back and forth from the creek to the other side. Like Boom Island is the other side of the outlet on the Mississippi River. And so people would transport back and forth across the river there. But the creek has had lots of names. So if it started with Hahawakpadan, the Dakota name, later, as the French moved into the area, it had a name. I'm not good at speaking French, but the Petite Rivière des Chutes.
That sounds good.
And then later, you know, it was also labeled just simply as Brook. There are two brothers. The Pond brothers were missionaries. When they came, they drew this cute little map of kind of the Lake of the Isles area and have Brook at the top. And that's actually Bassett Creek.
They have a rock on Bede Makaskaw with a little plaque that says this was where the Pond brothers' cabin was.
Yes, yes. And they even got some of the materials for their cabin from along the creek. I think it was elmwood, or basswood. They got these like strings that they could use to make the roof, I think, from along the creek. But so it was also known as Fall Creek or Nine Mile Creek when it was put on a map. I think in the 1830s, it was called Nine Mile Creek. So it's had lots of names over the years.
Not to be confused with the Nine Mile Creek in Bloomington.
Correct. There are two of them. Yes. And that 9 miles actually refers to Fort Snelling. That was kind of the center of the action when they were mapping things. And so 9 miles to the north was kind of the furthest northern edge of the military reservation, but then also 9 miles the other way. So the west side of the river was closed to European settlement until 1851. That's when a couple treaties are signed, the treaties of Mendota and Traverse des Sioux. But people couldn't wait. So they wanted to get over to this side right away. So folks came and lived on what was called the Fort Snelling Military Reservation. It was much bigger than what we think of as Fort Snelling today, not just those buildings, but that whole big area, 9 miles in a couple directions, was the big military reservation. And technically, people couldn't live on it until 1855. But like I said, they were so eager to get to this side of the river, they preempted that. They would preempt their claims. And so a guy named Joel Bean Bassett moves to the west side. He squats illegally at the mouth of the creek in the early 1850s. And so he sets up a little farm there and starts his business. He gets into lumber later. And eventually, one of the early school teachers in the area, Mary Augusta Schofield Kissel, names the creek after him. So that's where that name Bassett Creek came from.
Because his cabin was right there at the mouth of the creek.
Yep, sure. Because he was right there. Yeah. And he did many things in his life, but at that time, in the early 1850s, he hadn't done much in Minnesota yet. Minnesota had only been a state for a few years. And so at that time, he was mostly known as being the first probate judge in Hennepin County. If that's a great claim to fame, I don't know.
Makes me yawn.
Yeah. But he was over here on this side. There weren't a lot of people over here yet. So
gotta have a probate judge.
It's great. I think he only had to deal with like one will, and then he kind of got tired of it. So he didn't do it again.
Sure.
He also wasn't trained for it. He wasn't trained in the law or anything.
Maybe he could read.
But eventually he becomes an Indian agent. And there's a whole series of information about that. So the short story is that he made his original fortune selling Dakota homelands. He was into real estate. He made a huge bundle of money by selling this land that he preempted on the military reservation. So he's tied to the Dakota community that way.
So he takes a cut when he sells.
Well, he moves to the west side and stakes out this claim for himself. And then eventually in 1855, the U.S. government says, sure, yep, you can buy it at $1.25 an acre. You get a deal because you were there first and staked out your claim. So he buys it for $1.25 an acre. And then he sells it because Minneapolis is growing so quickly. He sells it for $250 an acre. That's really where he gets his start. But he's always been in lumber. He was in lumber before he came to Minnesota. And he continues that which eventually leads him to become an Indian agent up north. So he works with the Anishinaabe people, or at that time they were called the Ojibwe or Chippewa, essentially establishes the White Earth Reservation that happened while he was an Indian agent. But the creek is still here, and it's starting to carry this European name. And that's a really different way to think about the creek. Instead of being named Kahawakpadan after the falls and this relationship between the creek and the river, now it's named after just one guy, this Joel Bean Bassett, who's been here a couple years and hasn't really done much yet. So Bassett Creek, after that area opens to settlers, really undergoes some massive change. The settlers start to use it as a dumping ground. It's really the only creek that runs through the heart of Minneapolis. People think about Minnehaha Creek today, but at the time, Minneapolis was so small across the river from St. Anthony. It was just a little nucleus of a budding village. And so this creek, Bassett Creek, really became the major thoroughfare there.
And even today, the Minneapolis city limits are maybe a mile from where Minnehaha Falls is. So you're kind of out on the edge of the city when you're at Minnehaha Falls.
Yes, yes, very much. And Bassett Creek was right here. So it got used a lot in those early years, especially if you think about before modern plumbing. It became a little bit of a sewage pipeline. People would just dump everything in there. There were also slaughterhouses along the creek. Mm. People would dump in carcasses, bed springs, all the stuff you don't want would go in the water. And that's a really different way of thinking about the water. Instead of water being a source of life and life-sustaining, it became essentially a mobile trash device. You would just throw your garbage in the creek and hope it washed away. So by the late 1800s, it's pretty much an open sewer. But not only that, it's also flooding a lot. The eastern part of the creek would flood, and people who lived along the creek often didn't have a lot of money because that was sort of a transitory place to be. So they would get flooded out and then move back, and that goes on for years. And the city eventually decides, well, what if we just tunnel it? What if we just put it in a tunnel underground? So they do that in the 1920s. It's when you get pretty much to that Minneapolis border, it gets tunneled underground in 1920.
I thought it was even earlier than that, but I'm trying to imagine what the creek looked like in the 20s going through the warehouse district, right?
Yeah, because it also was a big ravine. It really went down, and so they had to build a lot of bridges over it. It was kind of a barrier to some of the development of Minneapolis on the north end. So they tunnel it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Joel Bassett.
So Joel grew up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire. He was born in 1817, and he gets into the lumber industry pretty early. He actually goes to Maine and works there until he's, you know, about middle-aged. I think he's somewhere in his early 30s when he moves to Minneapolis.
He comes to Minneapolis from Maine.
Yes.
Just like Andrew Robbins did.
Yes. There were a lot of folks who came from Maine.
I'm reaching for connections here.
But it was actually, Minnesota was known for that because people were moving west as they logged out those eastern states. They kept moving where the timber was. So Bassett comes here. He arrives on the very last day of 1849. I think he was in Stillwater, but he gets to St. Paul the first day of 1850. And that's important because then he can qualify for some special pioneer organization that's important to him. So he gets here in 1850. Eventually moves to St. Anthony, which is the eastern side of the Mississippi River, and then eventually to the west side, which becomes Minneapolis. So he really was one of the founding fathers of Minneapolis. And he gets into lumber. He had a lumber yard in St. Paul, so he'd drag the lumber back and forth from St. Anthony to St. Paul and sell it there. And then he starts a sawmill. He has one of the first sawmills on the west side of the river. And that's really his big deal, is the lumber for a long time.
Does he marry here? Did he bring a wife from Maine?
Good question. So
no, he's got kids.
He did. He had one child. So the records for women's history can be really spotty. And I can't tell if he was married and his first wife passed away and then he married her sister. That's one option. Or is it just one lady and there's really terrible records about her? Oh. I can't really tell. But so he does have a wife, and I can find almost nothing about her.
Sure.
I think she was not very well for most of her life because they were eventually rather wealthy. And so a lot of those wealthy wives do show up in the newspapers, but she does not.
Not in the social pages and
No. Yeah, none of it. I can only find one reference to her donating something, I think to a Masonic lodge or a temperance lodge, and that's it. So
Well, do we know if Joel was a teetotaler? Was he?
I think he was. I think he grew up Quaker, grew up in a Quaker family, and I think
Okay.
his wife did too.
Is that why maybe he became an Indian agent? Those folks tended to get those jobs.
Yes, he knew Bishop Whipple, who recommended him for the position. Bishop Whipple was trying to reform some of the ways that the U.S. government was interacting with Native American people, and he thought Joel would be a good candidate to do that. He thought he would be honest and a forthright representative. And it's hard to go back and tease apart those pieces of history. He was only an Indian agent for about 3 years in the 1860s, but a lot of things happened in those 3 years. Hole in the Day. Chief Hole in the Day was murdered. That happened while he was an Indian agent, and he didn't look into it very well.
And this was, he was an agent in Crow Wing County, and that's where that occurred. Is that right?
Yes, yep, up at the Crow Wing Agency. So this is more happening in the northern part of Minnesota, with the Anishinaabe. But also, there's a lot of white pine in northern Minnesota, so he might not have been totally disinterested in why he would want to be an Indian agent. So, was it out of the goodness of his heart, or was it because it was a business interest, or maybe some combination of the two? But right away, as soon as he's appointed, they also work on a treaty, the Treaty of 1867. He goes to Washington, D.C., with a group of Anishinaabe people and makes this treaty, which essentially establishes the White Earth Indian Reservation. So, that's up in northwestern Minnesota. And the idea was they would move all the Anishinaabe people there so they could be together and supposedly insulated from the poor effects of European settlers, but that would also mean the white pine is available.
Right.
If you move everybody out, you might have a
Yep.
better chance at getting into those forests. So, kind of a dual purpose there. So, they established the White Earth Reservation, and the spring of 1868, he goes up there and they pick out a spot for where this reservation is going to be.
So he was actually drawing lines on the map for that.
Yeah, picking out the places and then facilitating the removal of people there. So, about 200 Ojibwe people move there at first. And there are some quotes from Joel about he's disgusted with how the U.S. government treats American Indian people. And I think that's an accurate assessment. But there are also places where the things he says display how much he didn't understand about those relationships. So, as they're moving people, he has this quote, which just really emphasizes his own focus on assimilation. He says, "Never has the opportunity for weaning Ojibwe people from the habits and instincts of a savage life appeared so favorable." They're trying to get Anishinaabe people to leave the seasonal rounds, how they would move around and use the landscape at different times of the year,
Give
and
them a
instead,
plow.
yeah, get into farming. Yep. So he's doing that for a while as an Indian agent, but eventually moves on. After about 3 years, he resigns, and then he gets into a whole slew of other activities. He does flour milling, he does railroads, he's into newspapers, anything you can think of from the 1870s, he's into. Hydroelectric power at the falls in Minneapolis, so he's got it all.
Hydroelectric power. When did that kick in? Because I mean, I know he was active like right up through the 1890s and people were certainly using electricity then, but yeah, that's interesting. I had no idea he was. So he was selling electricity or just facilitating the building of the infrastructure?
Yes. In 1881, he co-founded what became the Minnesota Electric Brush Company. And that's the first centralized hydroelectric power in the United States. So you're generating this
We
power.
did it here. I had no idea.
By only like 3 days, there's like some other centralized hydroelectric power, but Minneapolis was the first. And Joel was right there doing it. So.
Yeah, I associate that with what, Niagara Falls or something.
Yeah. No, but the falls were this economic engine, this huge powerhouse for the city, which really is why Minneapolis is on the map where it is, because of the falls.
And look at it now, site.
Yes. And Nicollet Island is kind of interesting too. So when Joel decides that the west side is too stinky, right? Like he doesn't like all that industry, he moves to Nicollet Island, well, which even today you can go drive back there and see these amazing old houses that feels like you're back in the 1880s. It's kind of interesting to sit there and think about, oh, Joel could look out his window and watch the logs floating down the river that were funding his whole scheme.
And his house, do we know where it was on the Clodagh?
I think his house has been replaced by 3 townhomes, but I think it was on the west side of that island, so you could look out over that main part of the river and see all that traffic coming up and down.
Yeah.
There was a lot of industrialization around the creek. So because Joel Bassett owned that part right where the creek and the river meet, he kept part of it and sold part of it. It becomes platted into lots, small little city lots, but also a lot of industry. They start to have a railroad. They build over the bridge. There's sawdust everywhere. And eventually that stretch of the river gets so stinky that all the rich people move out. They don't want to be around all that industry anymore.
Well.
And over the years, people become more interested in caring for the creek. It takes about 50 years, but by the time we get to the 1970s, people are trying to do a little bit of a better job. And so they create the Bassett Creek Watershed Management Commission, has a plan to clean up the creek. And in the 80s, they really get involved with doing a lot of that. Because flooding remained an issue, they continue tunneling it, and then they actually decide to split it. So originally, the creek came out at a place called James Rice Park on Minneapolis. It goes under what is now Target Field, and then under the Star Tribune building, under the Itasca building, and then out into the river. That was the original outlet. But because it keeps flooding and there's a lot of issues, they decide they're going to tunnel it under downtown. So it goes under downtown Minneapolis and comes out just downstream of the falls. So starting in 1992, the creek is flowing under downtown Minneapolis. Approximately like every 15 years or so, someone suggests that we daylight Bassett Creek, bring it back and let the water see the sunshine again. And there have been some really cool plans for it, but it's never really come to fruition, mostly because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
Partly it's so expensive. And the other part is that once you get into downtown Minneapolis, people thought it would be really dangerous, that little kids would fall into the creek. It would fall down the ravine. How are we going to open up this big creek? So there's a couple different factors, but mostly I think the financing. So in the eastern part of the watershed, there's a place called Sumner Field Homes. It was public housing that was built in the 1930s. That's kind of the eastern part of the watershed. That area just west of the Minneapolis Farmers Market, kind of that 94 Olson Memorial Highway area. But kind of right from the beginning, it had some issues. They built all this public housing basically on a floodplain. So it's really soggy soil. The buildings start to sink. The foundations start to crack. And it becomes less and less taken care of. And so over time, people experiencing poverty get concentrated there. The city concentrates them there. And in 1998, the city settles a lawsuit and demolishes those homes. They decide to rebuild, refresh that part of the community, and they do bring back some of the wetlands. They do daylight some of that area. And you can go visit it today. You can see it from Highway 55. Yeah. Yeah, and it's getting more attention. They're cleaning up the creek. The Bassett Creek Watershed Management Commission pulls together, I think it's 9 different cities, so they can work together on some of those sustainability or conservation issues. Even this summer, they're doing work to improve the creek kind of through the eastern part of Golden Valley. And they've been a great partner as we've worked on the creek. In 2021, I think, we started an oral history project, the Hahawakpadan or Bassett Creek Oral History Project, where we worked with the indigenous community and interviewed 14 indigenous people from the West Metro. So people who live, work, or play in the watershed, about what does the creek mean to you? What would you like people to do to take care of the creek? And all of those interviews are available as a podcast if people are interested in finding
them. Yes, the Haha Wakpadan podcast. Yeah, I've listened to a bunch of them.
Yeah, and it's been a great project. So from that oral history project, it really grew into a community engagement effort. So working on policy with the city, we host a water blessing on Indigenous Peoples Day every year. Well, and we hope to bring that event to Robbinsdale in the future. It's a popular event, so we'll have to get it on the calendar. It's been really a pleasure to work with all these different cities and just trying to educate the community about Indigenous culture and history and helping people see this landscape in a new way. So that project has been really interesting because it was centered on this watershed, but also on community. It's been a nice combination. So there's a lot of connections. It's not always the most direct creek to look at, but you can kayak or canoe down it. And there's a map for that on the Bassett Creek Watershed Management Commission's website. Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one. City every Saturday to see our friends. In the bus back home, sitting hand in hand. When the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.